wherever the hell I want. And I'm not going to change for anybody. If I change, then I feel that I'm losing what 1969 brought into my life. And that was to be totally free.
And that last voice, Sylvia Rivera, in the documentary Remembering Stonewall, produced in 1999 by Dave Isay and Michael Shirker. Today marks the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. It began just after midnight tonight, 50 years ago, in Greenwich Village, and launched the modern day LGBTQ. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Tarina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Enrollment is now open for Henry Ford College summer classes, which begin Tuesday, June 25th. For more information and to register, please visit our website, hfcc.edu. You can also call HFC at 313-845-9600. See you on campus.
Winner of the Spirit of College Radio Award, broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn.
The gay liberation movement is widely recognized as having begun nearly 50 years ago in New York City. On June 28, 1969, patrons at a gay bar called the Stonewall Inn fought back against police harassment during a raid. Now, these raids happened on a regular basis, but for some reason, things were different that night. The riots lasted for 6 nights and sparked activism and a shift in perception of LGBT people. They would not hide who they were, and they demanded equal rights. I'm Stephanie Cohen, and this is Stonewall 50. In this hour-long documentary, we'll hear about the night in question from several people who were there.
I marched forward and with all my might kicked this policeman whose rear was presented to me as he bent over hitting somebody and knocked him down.
We'll also hear from a film professor about the evolution of media portrayals of LGBT people since the Stonewall Uprising.
It breaks the closet. It opens doors so that it's in people's living rooms. They could turn the channel. They could flip and get to it. They could be disgusted and turn it off. But it's there.
We'll hear from LGBT pioneers like Fred Sargent, who was an organizer of the first Pride March. We'll also hear from Keith St. John, the first openly gay African-American elected to public office, and Billy Bean, the only living openly gay Major League Baseball player, current or former.
And I just thought, I'm not going to go back and play anymore. I'm tired of being a liar. I'm tired of posing as something that I'm not. It was exhausting. And, you know, baseball's hard enough when everything is laid out in a perfect position for you to just focus on your playing.
The 1960s are a decade known for demanding change. People organized and took a stand for what they believed was right. Protesters tackled racism, gender inequality, and the Vietnam War. But even with this push for more inclusion and acceptance, life in the U.S. was still difficult for anyone considered different. Historian David Carter explains this was in part a side effect of the Cold War.
The Cold War also brought about, at times, a rise in Puritanism. There was a desire for conformity. We often hear this about the 1950s, that anything that was nonconformist, you know, even thought, was considered very dangerous. And the reason it was so terrible in the mid-60s is that the policies that had come into effect with the Cold War, there was a hardening of those policies in the 1960s. So They kept on passing laws and regulations that were more and more oppressive.
Though being gay wasn't technically illegal, all homosexual acts were illegal in every state besides Illinois throughout the 60s. On top of that, the American Psychiatric Association considered homosexuality a mental disorder. Plus, the lack of any anti-discrimination laws to protect LGBT individuals meant that if anyone found out you were gay, you could be abandoned by your friends and family, fired from your job, have your degrees or licenses revoked, and just generally be treated as inferior. So naturally, being out was not an option for most people, and the idea of being out and proud could just seem like a total anomaly. But more and more LGBT people began hearing about a place where there were people just like them, a place where people were unabashedly themselves. That place was a New York City neighborhood called Greenwich Village. To be clear, this wasn't a place where LGBT people lived in bliss and faced no resistance. In fact, by the mid-60s, police entrapment led to the arrest of 100 gay men each week. Homophobia also left many LGBT people homeless and unemployed. But still, the village was a gay enclave of sorts. People found power in numbers. The promise of a community and the chance to live openly drew waves of gay people to move to Manhattan. So very quickly, the city had a flourishing and visible LGBT community. But because of the attitudes at that time, that desire for conformity, lots of New Yorkers resented the newcomers. They wanted a crackdown from the police. One way the NYPD could appease these people and lawmakers was by raiding the several gay bars throughout the city. This proved to be easy because corruption was already the name of the game with New York's gay bar scene. David Carter explains this.
An honest person couldn't run a gay club or bar and make a profit. So the mafia, seeing a vacuum, an opening to make money, decided they would, you know, cater to this crowd. And then they would make super profits by, you know, serving watered-down liquor they'd stolen, and charging, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 times the normal rate for either walking into a club if they had a charge for walking in or off the sale of drinks.
Carter says the mafia-run bars, the state liquor authority, and the police were all in cahoots. The cops would let the bar owners know when the raids were planned. They'd come early in the evening, turn on the lights, ask for IDs, harass the customers a bit, maybe take a payoff, and soon enough, they'd be on their way. Carter says these raids were more about optics than anything else.
You know, as citizens put pressure on politicians. Politicians put pressure on the police raid. And, you know, from one point of view, you can sort of say everybody's happy, right? Because the police are getting paid off. The SLA is getting paid off. The judges and lawyers are getting paid off. The owners of the bars are making plenty of money. And then gay people have at least a place to go, you know. So from a certain, you know, point of view, that system worked. But, of course, from another point of view, it didn't work because, you know, the customers weren't happy with the fact they were being exploited.
Yet even with these raids and harassment from police officers, LGBT patrons continued to pledge their allegiance to the city's gay bars. The Stonewall Inn was a mafia-run gay bar on Christopher Street in the village, which people really took a liking to. Tommy Lanigan Schmidt was a regular at the Stonewall. He decided to move to the village from suburban New Jersey in 1967, when he was just 19. He says from the outside, the Stonewall looked like nothing special.
The Stonewall, when it was operating as the Stonewall that the riot happened, there was no glass in those windows. Those windows were covered with plywood painted black. That was in pretty bad shape. If you passed by that place back then, it looked like a place where, like, hot dog carts were stored. So it didn't look like there was a bar or anything going on in there.
Though the Stonewall's inconspicuous look was more to protect the bar owners from any further trouble, it had the added benefit of giving the bar's patrons a sense of security from the outside world. The bar was also known for having the best jukebox around. They played music that really got people up and dancing. There was something else that set this place apart from the other gay bars in the city. At the Stonewall, people could actually slow dance with each other. This wasn't an option for LGBT people at other bars. They would be pulled apart and kicked out if they were seen touching, let alone sharing an intimate slow dance. Lanigan Schmidt says, as a young gay man, having this opportunity to slow dance with someone was just amazing.
So you're coming into a gay life back then, and everything was centered around sex. See, you were just told, like, oh, everything was sex, which wasn't bad, but you need more. So that prelude of dancing changes everything because you're told by life itself that you're a real person because you're holding on to someone. See, a heterosexual doesn't have to think about that because, like, they just do it, and it's just part of growing up.
While the Stonewall was reliable for a good time, as a gay bar, it was still subject to frequent police raids. Though, like Carter said, the raids were meant to appease angry citizens and politicians, there was still pervasive homophobia and transphobia displayed in the raids. cops were known to take people into the bathroom and carry out anatomical inspections, where they'd force people to prove their sex matched their gender identity based on their outfits that night. If there were males wearing dresses, for example, the police had the right to arrest them. Even on nights the police didn't make any arrests, the raids were still disruptive and abusive in their nature. The Stonewall patrons became understandably fed up with the routine. Historian David Carter says by the early summer of 1969, the relationship between the cops and the owners of the Stonewall was becoming more complicated. This was because NYPD had appointed a new head of the Vice Department, Inspector Seymour Pine. Carter describes Pine as extremely honest and incorruptible. He was a rule follower. So when he was assigned to shut down the Stonewall Inn because of a blackmail operation going on behind the scenes, Pine took the assignment very seriously. Carter says about a week before the famous riots at the Stonewall, Pine had an interaction with one of the owners that sparked anger in him.
Pine had raided the club earlier in the week, and as he was leaving, one of the mafia managers said to him, "Okay, you want to shut us down, so what, we'll be open tomorrow." And that really made Pine angry. So he was going to do everything he could to make this raid effective.
While planning the next raid, Pine decided he'd make some changes to the way things routinely went down. First, he had realized the early evening raids were ineffective, so he decided they'd go late, when the bar was full and guard was down. He also chose not to let the 6th Precinct know when they were raiding, because he figured out they were tipping off bar owners. And finally, he assigned 4 undercover cops to go into the bar before the raid occurred, for added support. But Pine's serious attitude wasn't the only thing that had been growing. So too was the air of resistance from the Stonewall patrons. The raids were unjust and dehumanizing, and they were tired of putting up with them. Something needed to change. Just after 1 a.m. on Saturday, June 28, 1969, Pine and 7 other police officers showed up at the Stonewall Inn. The bar owners hadn't been tipped off about the raid, so they were caught off guard. The lights went on, the music cut out, and the exits were blocked. There were about 200 people in the bar that night. The police demanded everyone line up and be ready to present their IDs and cooperate during anatomical inspections. These inspections were usually met with little resistance, but on this night, the trans folk at the bar put up a fight. They told police to get their hands off of them and were shouting things like, "I have my rights." Meanwhile, everyone who wasn't arrested was released and told to get out. But rather than leave, they started to gather outside. The crowd gained attention and started growing. Robert Bryan, a Stonewall regular, was out with his friends on Christopher Street, not far from the bar. He says they caught wind of what was happening from a passerby.
Some guy came running down the street like a latter-day Paul Revere, shouting that the police were raiding the Stonewall. And get up to the Sheridan Square, get up to Stonewall, there's something happening, there's a crowd. So we made our way up there. And when we got there, there was a crowd in front of the Stonewall, and people were being ushered out. And often the people would come out and they would throw their arms up, or they would take a bow, or they would carry on in some way, in some campy way. And the whole atmosphere was very festive and fun at that point. And everybody was laughing and screaming and throwing campy remarks back and forth with the people coming out.
But as the crowd grew in size and resistance, the police started using more force. They were bringing more people out from inside the bar, and being especially rough. Brian describes how quickly things started to change.
So they were fun at first, but then a policeman started shoving them around, and one of the drag queens hit the policeman with her purse, and he did not take it in a fun, campy way. He hit her with the club, and at this point, the mood of the crowd started to change.
This display of force didn't scare the crowd into fleeing. They weren't going anywhere. Historian David Carter says the turning point from still somewhat contained to just chaotic came when the police brought a lesbian woman they were trying to arrest out of the bar.
She was really furious and fighting with the police coming out. Apparently she'd been clubbed inside. And they took her into a police car, and she got out and tried to go back to the Stonewall. and they put her in the car again. Again, she escaped. And this went on over about 5 or 10 minutes, and she was really fighting the police and going wild. This upset the crowd because they witnessed this woman being brutalized in front of them. And eventually she or another lesbian said, you know, why are you guys all standing around? Why don't you do something?
This moment lit a fire in the crowd. They really started to fight back. Tommy Lanigan Schmidt says he remembers street youth like himself being scrappy and jumping in first.
To have this effrontery of the police, you know, coming in and acting like they can just push us around just because they feel like it. It sparked anger in everyone. The street kids and then the kids who were going to like NYU or Columbia, we were the ones who jumped in right away. But the other people did too. The people that had jobs they could lose because there's a big crowd there. So like people like lose themselves in the crowd.
People started using whatever they could to fight back. The crowd noticed piles of brick laying around and they used them as ammo, throwing them at the police. They threw trash cans and lighter fluid-soaked rags and pulled cobblestone and parking meters from the ground. Witnesses say the sound of the heavy objects hitting the ground and police cars was loud and frightening, which only added to the chaos. Robert Bryan says he got in on the action himself.
I was in the front of the crowd, and I marched forward and with all my might kicked this policeman whose rear was presented to me as he bent over hitting somebody and knocked him down. And at this point, one of the other policemen tried to grab me, and I took off running. After, I don't know, 5 or 6 blocks, I realized that I had lost him, and I doubled back to what was happening. And, I mean, all hell had broken loose.
Word of the riot spread quickly, and people started showing up in waves to join in. As the crowd grew and things continued to escalate, the police were forced to retreat back into the Stonewall while they waited for backup. The crowd used a parking meter as a battering ram to try to get at the police. Historian David Carter says the late Inspector Pine told him in an interview that he had never been as scared as he was the first night of the Stonewall Uprising, not even during his years spent as a combat soldier in World War II. Though he was terrified, Carter says Pine was also focused on making sure none of his officers shot at the crowd.
And he went to each officer, put his hand on that officer's shoulder, said his name, and said, hold your fire until I say fire. Don't fire before I fire, no matter what happens. And then he would say to all of them, if anybody fires before I fire, you're going to be walking the loneliest beat in Staten Island for the rest of your life.
Eventually, the tactical police force showed up and freed the officers from the bar. It took until about 4 a.m. for the streets to clear. Some people were taken to the hospital, others were arrested. Carter says the police were resentful because they had been bested by the group of people who they least expected to fight back, let alone come out on top. For the next 5 nights, riots continued outside of the Stonewall. Thousands of people showed up to show their solidarity to the fight for the LGBT community to be treated with dignity. Carter says he thinks the LGBT people at Stonewall that night tapped into a collective unconscious. They were sick of the years of being discriminated against and harassed.
You know, you had the right to take it away. Look, you've got all this out here. You know, you've got 99.99999% of everything it is. You give us this little bit, and you're going to come and take this away from us and raid it all the time and hassle us?
Carter relates the Stonewall riots to other iconic moments in American history, like Rosa Parks refusing to sit at the back of the bus, or Martin Luther King Jr. giving his I Have a Dream speech in front of the Lincoln Memorial.
All countries have their moments in their history that have a special power, and it goes beyond the power that can be grasped through a rational analysis of the event. And I think you find that in Stonewall for several reasons. One is, I think it's essentially the kind of story where the least likely person wins. So the fact that you had this mafia club that's very seedy, and then those who revolt against the police, many of them on the front lines are transvestites or Puerto Rican or street youth. And you have this butch lesbian who comes out and she, you know, stirs up the crowd. It has all these elements. Plus, I think the most beautiful thing of all is that it was totally spontaneous, totally unplanned. This is the stuff that legends have always been made of. So I think that's why the story of Stonewall has symbolic value and continues to inspire people.
Those six nights did inspire people to continue the fight for LGBT liberation. Stonewall marked a drastic turning point for gay activists, where they shifted from silent sit-ins to vocal marches. WFUV's Caroline Albacete shares how their activism evolved.
LGBT activism in America has roots going back to the 1950s. 19 years before the Stonewall riots, activists created groups such as the Mattachine Society and Daughters of Bilitis. But at the time, homosexuality was illegal, so members had to be conscious of their actions. Eric Marcus is the host of the podcast Making Gay History. Marcus says gay people faced serious legal consequences for their affiliations with the groups.
At first, the organizations were focused on helping people come to understand who they were, and then also fighting for the men anyway, fighting entrapment, and for both the men and women, fighting police oppression and abuse.
The organizations dubbed themselves as homophile groups because it means gay-loving. Members used fake names and proclaimed they loved gay people. But they were very clear that they weren't gay themselves. They not only wanted to protect themselves, but they also wanted to present themselves as polished and family-friendly. Carla J. was an LGBT activist and founding member of the Gay Liberation Front. J. says LGBT people just wanted to be accepted. But a lot of times for that to happen, they had to conform to societal norms.
They were fairly white. They were middle class, and when they had their annual Day of Reminder, which was at the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia, and they marched around with picket signs, the men had to wear suits and ties, and the women had to wear skirts or dresses.
For the radical young activists who would lead the charge after Stonewall, it didn't seem like enough.
The women who were at the Daughters of Bilitis seemed to me, even prior to Stonewall, a little bit old and a little bit staid. So I was more interested in radical activism, and I didn't join until after the Stonewall, when more radical groups seemed to come to the fore.
While they respected the efforts of their predecessors, the post-Stonewall activist generation was tired of the closet. Stonewall was a tipping point. In the aftermath, LGBT activists traded suits and dresses for t-shirts with bold slogans, and quiet protests for marches. Jay says that after Stonewall, conformity was no longer an option.
That is what the Stonewall Uprising gave to us. It gave us our dignity as queer individuals. It said, we are here, we're queer, get used to it. And if you don't like who we are, get out of our way.
Visibility was the name of the game. The social climate in the U.S. in the late 60s and early 70s lent itself to radicalization. At the same time the Black Panther Party and the Young Lords of Harlem fought against racism, the Gay Liberation Front, or GLF, stepped up to carry the banner for the LGBT community. Jay believes the group paved the road for a new type of activism.
So there was this whole background, you have to understand, for the uprisings, the rebellion at the Stonewall Inn. And so in the wake of that rebellion, we, the members of the Gay Liberation Front, kind of lit a torch in the ashes of the Stonewall, and we took that torch, and we started to march as soon as a month after the Stonewall uprisings. But we did have that spirit of activism, of peaceful activism, and of getting together, and the spirit was enough.
The GLF was the first organization founded after the riots. It was the standard bearer for the LGBT community. The vocabulary we have today concerning sexual and gender identity did not yet exist, but the group strove to be intersectional. It used gay as an umbrella term for various identities. Jay says the group focused its attention on two different goals, advocating for socio-political change and preserving LGBT culture.
I have to say that because we were so diverse as a group, that we were often like one big dysfunctional family when we met. In fact, the name Front is meant to indicate a kind of umbrella organization under which different caucuses or groups formed. In general, there were two divisions. There was a Red Butterfly Cell, which was a radical Marxist kind of group that was a proponent of leftist ideology, and they felt that the best way to achieve freedom was for gay men and lesbians and trans people to take to the street and picket and to force change on institutions. Then there was what we called the Aquarius Cell. And the Aquarius group felt that we should focus on creating our own society so that when a cultural revolution happened, or if one didn't, that we would still have our own cultural world that they could never take away from us.
The GLF was not meant to last, however. It was meant to ignite the fight, which was then carried on by other organizations. Groups that formed in the GLF's wake, such as the Lavender Menace, continued its mission of promoting visibility. But their focus tended to be on specific identities. Composed of lesbian women, the Lavender Menace broke into the women's movement. The group addressed the isolation and discrimination lesbian women faced. GLF founding member Carla Jay later helped create the Lavender Menace. Jay says the group performed zaps on women's conferences and changed the National Organization for Women's perspective on the LGBT community.
We knew that on March 1st, 1970, there was going to be a big conference in Greenwich Village called the Second Congress to Unite Women. And before the Congress started, Jessica cut off all the lights in the auditorium, and the whole place went black. And when the lights went up, the audience was completely surrounded by lesbians in Lavender Menace t-shirts, holding signs that said things like, "We are your worst nightmare, we are your best fantasy, take a lesbian to lunch." And this was called a zap, this kind of action. It was meant to be somewhat funny and lighthearted, because the intention of a zap was to get the group you were zapping on your side a little bit.
The Gay Switchboard of New York worked alongside the Lavender Menace. Founded in 1971, the Switchboard carried on the Gay Liberation Front's mission of community building. At its inception, the Switchboard provided resources about LGBT organizations to gay men and youth. Today, the Switchboard still provides information about LGBT groups. It's now a part of the National LGBT Help Center. Brad Becker is the Switchboard's current leader. He says that in the 70s, raising awareness about the LGBT community was itself a radical act because newspapers refused to even print the word gay.
The goal of the Switchboard when it first started was to bring the community together, and it was the beginning of a lot of new organizations forming in New York City. And unless you knew about them through word of mouth, predominantly, you wouldn't know they existed. And so initially the Switchboard was intended to give out resource information.
The Gay Switchboard didn't only provide information about LGBT groups. It also supplied gay men with knowledge about safe sex practices. Later on, it presented a safe space for scared LGBT youths to turn to for general information about the realities of gay life. In the 80s, those resources became critical. When the HIV/AIDS crisis hit in the 80s, the radical activism that Stonewall had sparked became even more extreme. The LGBT community was once composed of individuals with different agendas and ways of advocating. They came together in the wake of the crisis to fight for their right to survive. Carla Jay of the GLF and Lavender Menace believes that the shift in approach helped change society.
And with radical queers, the mainstream LGBTQ organizations seem more palatable to listen to. So when you've got ACT UP standing there and throwing blood in your face, it makes HRC sound like a really nice group of people to sit down with in a conference room. But you need both of those groups to get out there and do what they can do to create social change.
The progress that the LGBT community has made today is a result of the activism that began before Stonewall and radicalized after the riots. Groups like ACT UP and the Switchboard work underneath the LGBT umbrella to continue the fight. Brad Becker of the LGBT Switchboard says they can do so thanks to those who raised the banner after Stonewall.
Many of our volunteers realize that they are symbolically sitting in the chair of all of the people that came before them in those 47 years, many of those people who unfortunately are no longer with us. And so there's a great sense of continuing that and making sure that while it's entrusted to us, we make sure that we leave it stronger for the next person that comes along into the organization.
Stonewall was a turning point in history. Like Becker says, it will forever be remembered by LGBT activists across the U.S. for its profound impact on the fight for LGBT rights.
That was WFUV's Caroline Albacete on the history of LGBT activism. While you may not have already been familiar with the organizations in Caroline's story, it is likely you've heard of, or even been to, a pride parade. These happen every year in cities all around the world, usually in June, to line up with the anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. They're everywhere now, but there was a time when there was only one. The first pride march was in New York City in 1970, a year after the uprising. Up until that point, LGBT activism had consisted of a few demonstrations called annual reminders in Philadelphia. At these reminders, LGBT picketers sought respect by trying to be as uncontroversial as possible. Women wore dresses, men wore suits and ties, and the crowd was there to politely remind people that the LGBT community deserved to enjoy equal rights. Fred Sargent and his then-partner Craig Rodwell were activists from New York, who came down to Philly each year to attend these demonstrations. Rodwell had actually come up with the original idea for these polite pickets. But they felt that the annual reminders had some shortcomings. So Rodwell, Sargent, and their friends and fellow activists started to plan a different kind of march, one that didn't mirror the annual reminders. Sargent says,
"We thought that that was just too confining. Often when you saw people walking on the picket line, it was a male and a female walking, just so that it would be less upsetting to straight people."
Sargent recalls being at an annual reminder one year and seeing two women who were holding hands when an organizer ran over to them and slapped their hands apart. Sargent says the march he planned, called the Christopher Street Liberation Day March, would be quite different.
"So we wanted to rid ourselves of those sorts of constraints. There was no dress code that was laid out in the proposal. People were to come as they were."
The annual reminders usually had less than 100 demonstrators come out. But for the Christopher Street Liberation Day, there was a much larger crowd anticipated. This was due to the fact that Sargent's partner, Craig Rodwell, owned the Oscar Wilde Bookshop, which was the country's first bookstore devoted to LGBT authors. This meant they had access to a sizable mailing list of people who might be interested in the new march. When the day came, Sargent was at the front of the pack. He says the size of the crowd at the first march was astonishing.
"And I remember after marching a number of blocks, getting up on a telephone pole stanchion and looking back and just seeing what seemed like a mile of people behind me. It was quite beyond my expectations. At the time, people were so closeted. I was living an out life, and that was the exception. So to see these people being able to come together for an event that we had put together and turn out was perfect for me as far as an outcome. I couldn't have asked for a better outcome."
But these days, the Pride marches look hardly anything like the vision the original planners had. Sargent says the nature of this day has turned into a parade more than a march.
"The difference in Pride from when we first organized it and what it's become today is striking. The march was intended to be a commemorative march, a demonstration, and it was to have full public participation. That's not happening so much now. Now the march is given over to corporate sections and there are barricades everywhere. Now it's not a demonstration. Now it is an event. It's a parade. And it's not what we had intended.
Despite how the march has changed, Sargent still remains very proud of what he and the other organizers accomplished. He says he knew from the start this event would create change. By showing up, demanding rights, and being openly proud of who they were, marchers were able to change public perception.
As part of that human experience, as you age, you tend to think about things, think about your life, what have you done, and have you done anything that's meant anything? And I've never had that question in my mind. I knew then that what we were doing was going to make a difference, and I feel it has.
Despite how far the LGBT community has come since Stonewall, coming out still isn't easy for everyone. It wasn't for Billy Beane. He didn't come out as gay until after he hung up his cleats as a professional baseball player. Beane played for both the Detroit Tigers and LA Dodgers in the late 80s. Today, he's the MLB's ambassador for inclusion. WFUV sports reporter Emmanuel Barbari talked with Beane about the challenges of being gay in baseball.
Billy, thanks again for taking some time.
It's my pleasure, Emmanuel.
You played in Major League Baseball. What made it so hard to come out during your playing career at that time, playing in the 90s?
Well, at that time, there was never a conversation that was respectful or inclusive or accepting about the LGBT community. I grew up, my dad was in the Marine Corps. I come from a religious family. I'm the oldest of five boys. I was in the big leagues as a very young man. Played sports my whole life. I never really met anybody that told me they were gay before I got to the big leagues, you know, that said the words, you know, where there was a conversation. And I did not identify as gay at that time. I got married very young. And I think I identified as a baseball player. And every comment, every, you know, the disparaging ways that men talk about each other usually is feminizing them and inevitably words that are disparaging to gay males specifically at that time was a loud message to keep my mouth closed. And, you know, to get to the big leagues is a tremendous accomplishment. And what was difficult for me is that even through those obstacles, I met somebody that I left my marriage for, fell in love, and he died suddenly, you know, 3 years into our relationship as a very young person. And it just felt like at that time, there were too many examples that I didn't belong where I was. And that was an oversight and a mistake that I made. I never gave baseball a chance to be accepting or help me. And I wish I had given my teammates or a couple teammates that I was close to or the sport or my employer, San Diego Padres at the time, a chance. But I didn't do that because we weren't vocal enough about what our values were.
You mentioned some of that culture in Major League Baseball. Do you think at the time, had you known and then made a decision to speak out about it, would there have been even more backlash than there would have been today?
Yeah, there were. To start that conversation at the very peak of professional male team sports, there was no foundation for conversations on college campuses. I mean, I think there was a couple of civil rights protests, but they were pretty much exclusively around the government's inability to prioritize people that were living with HIV and medications. This wasn't about civil rights. This was about people dying. And so that was a hard thing to relate to me because I was very young and naive and uninformed and ironically, that is how my partner passed away, so I was confronted with something like that. But I certainly am not the type of person, I didn't have that character to carry the torch of a conversation of that magnitude while I was, you know, fighting every single day just to stay in the major league. So I don't think I was equipped with that capacity. I wish I knew then what I know now about myself and about baseball, but I didn't. And so I don't think it was ever a consideration because I just wasn't in a position to make that choice.
In the preceding days and months to your retirement, how difficult was that decision? And Did that battle that you eventually had to face have anything to do with that decision?
Absolutely. I hadn't even told my family that I was gay. I had never introduced them to my partner. My partner died suddenly. I was, you know, hiding that secret, living a double life, grieving the loss of someone. I didn't even go to his funeral because I had a game. And I could not come up with a reason to, you know, miss a game. It was, you know, like devastating, awful choices that I have to live with. And so I think once the structure of that final season ended, just a natural human reaction to that grief or whatever. And I just thought, I'm not going to go back and play anymore. I'm tired of being a liar. I'm tired of posing as something that I'm not. It was exhausting. And, you know, baseball's hard enough when everything is laid out in a perfect position for you to just focus on your playing. So it contributed to my decision. And you know, that's a tough, bitter pill to swallow.
Do you think in today's game that your decision would have been different, given that the climate has become maybe not as inclusive as you'd hope, but closer to that point?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, I do want to say that I have great optimism that if there's someone out there in the big leagues playing with the same situation that I was playing in, that they have a support network that, you know, their family, a loved one, perhaps a teammate. And I think baseball is absolutely ready for a player if they can see that the player is all about baseball. You know, it's very, very hard, very, very competitive. Careers are dynamic, and you have an opportunity to, you know, maximize a life's, you know, work in a very short period of time. And I think that that is contributing to the decisions that maybe athletes about not coming forward. And, you know, as a grown man, that boys, males, we're taught to sort of armor up and keep it inward. You know what I mean? Just make it about like what's going on and not like, you know, open up too much. And sometimes that's to our detriment, but that's a hard sort of habit to break.
If there were to be a way to change that inwardness, what do you think that would be?
Well, I think it has to do with conversations about understanding for us to be our best self. We have to be healthy, you know, from here up as well. And if are things good at home? Is there you know, stressful things that you're doing that are, you know, are you getting enough rest? Are you eating right? Are you in a, you know, toxic relationship? Are you drinking alcohol? Are you, you know, succumbing to peer pressure and, you know, participating in drugs or things like that that have your trajectory, your well-being? There's so many things that have to be sacrificed in order to succeed at the highest level.
From the lens of a young player, how hard is it to get in the routine of everyday baseball and stay in the moment of a game?
So it's very hard. The greatest players that I played around with or against, their ability to eliminate distraction was unbelievable. And I mean, I was on the team with them and I would watch them. You know, they had wives and kids and lives and financial investments and people pulling on them because they were so, you know, influential. And yet, but man, when they got ready to get dressed for the game, just everything goes away. And I saw a lot of guys in the minor leagues that I thought were going to be amazing players, and then they got to the big leagues and they couldn't eliminate those distractions because they just started to think too much, is what we, you know, how we, you know, characterize that. So in my opinion, it seems like a lot of athletes, the reason we don't have athletes that are out right now is they're saying, you know what, I'm good. I'm happy. I'm in the big leagues. My family, everyone's in line. Someday I'll be ready. But, you know, a lot of our players are under the age of 25. It takes a while to sort of come into your own emotionally and understanding, you know, all those ancillary parts of your life that don't specifically define you as a person, but are absolutely a part of you. And right now, front and center, you know, athletes, it is a 100% commitment. That's why, you know, you see historically relationships are difficult for a young player. You know what I mean? It just takes, there's so many reasons that add to why or why not things happen. I do think there are just multiple examples of, from the top down, that our owners, our general managers, the presidents of ball club management, coaching staffs, teammates, they want every player to feel like they are part of the family and loved, and if they're going to give 100% of their focus on being a great teammate.
Thanks so much for taking some time. I really appreciate your insight. 50 years since Stonewall.
All right, my pleasure. Look forward to next time.
That was Emmanuel Barbari talking with Billy Beane, the only openly gay MLB player, current or former. Today, the political arena has many LGBT players. Even one of the presidential candidates, Pete Buttigieg, is openly gay. But that hasn't always been the case. Keith St. John was the first African-American openly gay politician in the country. He served in Albany's Common Council from 1990 until 1998. WFUV's Natalie Migliori sat down with St. John.
Did you always know you wanted to go into politics?
Well, the quick answer is no. I didn't start getting wet for the arena of politics until probably once I got out of law school. I saw an announcement for a meeting for folks who might want to get a sense of what politics was like in Albany. So this was essentially a recruitment notice. I went to this meeting for potential campaign volunteers. And much to my surprise, the folks who had organized the meeting decided that I was probably better suited not as a campaign volunteer, but as a candidate. And so that was literally in the summer of 1988, the first instance or opportunity that I had to really consider becoming very much actively, instead of passively, very much actively involved in politics.
And so at that point, were you openly gay?
Well, the quick answer is yes. I had come out when I was a first-year student in law school. Not only did I have to overcome and survive the challenges at being black in the late 60s and early 70s, now all I seem to have done was place another layer of discrimination, another reason for being treated badly, another factor that perhaps, as my mother might think, militated against my success.
Did you get any pushback from the people in the community as you were running your campaign?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. So my contest was in the primary election that was going to be held in September of 1989. And through the course of the summer, I was busy walking the streets and knocking on as many doors and really having real good conversations with voters. Overnight before the primary election, someone literally distributed flyers, 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper, either affixing them to doorknobs or doorsteps or windshields on automobiles, something to the effect, a flyer to the effect that a vote for Keith St. John would be a vote for essentially someone wearing, you know, red high heels, and that if I were elected to the city council, the gay agenda, the quote-unquote gay agenda, would completely take over the city of Albany, and all that the city council would be doing would be advancing the arguably narrow interests of gays and lesbians. I panicked. Oh, and I discovered that the flyer had been dropped with very little time to respond. I thought, there went my campaign and 2.5 months of hard work in the hot summer heat, knocking on doors. As it turned out, it blew up in their faces. The reaction from even the voters was negative. And I was able to come out victorious in that first foray into local politics and become the first openly gay black elected to public office anywhere at any level in the United States.
And what challenges did you face as an openly gay lawmaker at the time when homosexuality wasn't as accepted as it is today?
That lack of acceptance, I think back in the late 80s, so much of it was driven by simple and pure ignorance. So the challenge for me was in overcoming the ignorance and sometimes even the fear born out of that ignorance. And my task was to enable my colleagues to see through however they wanted to brush me and paint me and see me for the person, the professional, the intelligent person who wanted to do as good a job representing the interests of their community as my own colleagues did. My task was to get them to know who I was before fearing what I was.
How well do you think the LGBTQ community across the nation is represented by politicians today?
You're seeing now an openly gay man as a candidate for president of the United States. That would have been unheard of 30 years ago, but our numbers are much more visible now than they have been ever before, and I don't doubt that our visibility will only increase because of the continuing successes that we make and that we promote and that we share that enables others to learn of our success and be comfortable in having a sense that the obstacles and that the barriers that existed decades and decades ago continue to fall and fall under their own weight.
And so what, if anything, still needs to change?
There's still room to go, I guess, in terms of people's appreciation for our own sort of human rights and our own innate dignity, in terms of who we can love as a person, who we can share a home and a household with. There's a lot as a community that we continue to learn, as well as those outside of our community about us. So the dynamic will always be, I think, a rich one, but it's an important one that engages those of us in the community with those of us outside of the community so that the exchange of information can inure to everyone's benefit.
Thank you, Keith.
My pleasure. Thank you again.
Keith St. John was the first openly gay African-American politician in the country. He talked with WFUV's Natalie Migliori. The LGBT community is widely represented in film and television today, from Pose to Moonlight to Call Me By Your Name. But it was a long road to get to this point. WFUV's Julia Rose Herman has more on that evolution.
Tammy Gold is a filmmaker and professor of film and media at Hunter College. She says that since the Stonewall riots, the representation of the LGBT community in the media has come a long way. She says before Stonewall, the media mostly focused on gay men, not necessarily in glowing fashion. Take The Rejected, a documentary made for television. It aired in 1961. Gold says it was one of the first pieces of televised media to represent homosexuality.
And these were very condescending.
This is a program about homosexuality. What causes it? Is there a cure for it? What does the homosexual say about his condition? What does society feel about the homosexual?
And it was always in the framework that we have to discuss this disease. And if you think about the TV show The Homosexuals in 1967...
Most homosexuals, if they had a chance to be heterosexual, would they?
Well, I have a friend who took a poll of 300 people on that very question. He asked them, if you were able to take a pill to change yourself from a homosexual to a heterosexual, would you do it? And something like 95% of them answered no.
But in that same poll, if I'm not mistaken, the majority said that they would not want, if they had one, a son or a brother to be a homosexual.
That's true. I think some people might not want to wish on others a situation in which society would cause problems for their younger people.
An American media personality, Michael Wallace, was the host of that documentary. As Gold explains, Wallace interviewed gay men, along with psychiatrists and lawmakers, to gather different viewpoints on homosexuality.
Most of the people interviewed were in silhouette, which basically meant that homosexuality had to be hidden. So these programs further put people in the closet just by hiding people's faces.
The dilemma of the homosexual. Told by the medical profession he is sick. By the law that he is a criminal. Shunned by employers, rejected by heterosexual society. Incapable of a fulfilling relationship with a woman or, for that matter, with a man. At the center of his life, he remains anonymous, a displaced person, an outsider.
It was just 2 years after this documentary aired that the Stonewall riots took place. Gold says after Stonewall, there was a lot of progress in how the media depicted gay men.
In 1970, they were Boys in the Band.
Boys in the Band tells the story of a birthday celebration gone wrong. Michael, the host of the party, gets an unexpected visit from an old friend, Alan. Alan is straight and everyone else at the party is gay. The film received criticism because it played on stereotypes.
Goodbye, Hank. It was awfully nice meeting you.
Same here, Alan.
When we get to Washington, I'd like you to meet my wife.
Right, good.
Oh, that'd be fun, wouldn't it, Hank?
They'd love to meet him. Her. I have Spencer's problem with pronouns.
How many S's are there in the word problem?
How'd you like to kiss my ass? That's got two or more S's in it.
But Gold says, at the same time,
it breaks the closet. It opens doors so that it's in people's living rooms. They could turn the channel. They could flip and get to it. They could be disgusted and turn it off. But it's there.
In the 1980s, Gold says the focus of media attention on the gay community shifted to a then mysterious disease that was afflicting gay men.
There's many other films that started to percolate in the 80s, the early 80s, mid-80s, that took on the issue of AIDS.
Like Parting Glances, which came out in 1986. It is about a gay man caring for his ex-lover who has HIV.
Hey, you could have my TVs, all right?
Stop.
It's your video? It's my will.
Put it away.
Just show me where it is.
What bullshit. You know France is working,
On this new drug that we should get by the year 2000. Maybe we should go to France.
Okay.
Gold says this was one of the first films to address HIV, but it wasn't the last.
In 1993, a movie came out called And the Band Played On, Politics, People, and the AIDS Epidemic. And that's a very important piece.
Set in 1981, an epidemiologist sets out to investigate an increased rate of death among gay men in urban areas.
I know that we're dealing with a very complex and highly emotional issue, but it would help a lot.
I wonder how you can expect us to be unemotional when at least one person is dying every day from a disease that doesn't even have a name. Now, if the CDC can't bother to come up with a name, at least it should stop the media from calling it GRID. We have enough people hating gays without having the entire stigma of this disease placed on us, especially since it has been shown that this disease is no longer merely gay-related. Now, I make a motion to officially call this disease acquired immune deficiency syndrome, or AIDS.
As representation of the LGBT community increased in the media, Gold says the idea of a more accurate representation became a topic of conversation.
There's many films that critique Hollywood, some documentaries, and they really look at Hollywood in terms of pulling away the cover.
The Celluloid Closet in 1995 was one of those documentaries. It surveyed Hollywood screen depictions of homosexuals. It featured media personalities like Susan Sarandon and Whoopi Goldberg, and uncovered various stereotypes of the gay population.
It's the myth.
To be a gay man meant that you not only did you wear pinch clothes and you had this kind of look on your face, but you carried a purse as well.
It's the girls.
I think the feeling is two women are together, then it's probably experimental or some kind of phase. And, you know, if the right guy came along, that would all change.
It's the guys.
You know, that's why people say, oh, I'm a man. Like, being a man is based on who you happen to be boning that day.
Then, by 2010...
You have The Kids Were All Right, which is about a lesbian couple having had two children in a alternative family structure.
Hey, Bug.
Don't be back late.
I know. Come give us a hug before you go.
Hugs.
Hug her. That's what she's there for.
Have you thought any more about making that call?
That could really hurt Mom's feelings.
How can you not even be curious about it?
Each of my moms had a kid with your sperm.
Like in both of them.
Uh-huh, like in gay.
Right on.
Cool, I love lesbians.
Gold says representation started to become more and more positive and inclusive.
There's a whole movement that we could see, certainly at this moment, with Orange is the New Black, where you have a lot of lesbians whose characters are fully developed.
How am I back here?
They got your number now, honey.
This is gonna get interesting.
I don't trust any of you crazies.
It's just like the Hamptons, only horrible.
I'm an inmate. I have nothing.
The doors have been smashed and people can leave the closet. Doesn't mean there's not repercussions. People have to be vigilant. We have to always be acting up.
Stonewall 50 is a production of WFUV News. It was written and produced by me, Stephanie Cohen, with help from Caroline Albacete, Emmanuel Barbari, Natalie Migliori, and Julia Rose Herman, and was edited by George Bodarkey. You can find an archive of this and other WFUV specials on WFUVnews.org. Thanks for listening.
The Henry Ford Centennial Library will temporarily be closed to the public from Monday, May 20th through fall 2019 for a major renovation project. In order to serve residents during this closure, both the Bryant Branch Library and the Esper Branch Library will be extending their hours beginning June 1st, 2019. Please visit DearbornLibrary.org for renovation updates and more detailed information regarding specific library services.
Listener-supported non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn, winner of the Spirit of College Radio Award.
And that's where my baby stays.